This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580, the Information Advantage. Celeste Quinn is away. I'm Tom Rogers. Our technical director this afternoon is Jason Croft, and producing the show this afternoon is Harriet Williamson. Our guest in the 1 o'clock hour is the same guest we had scheduled for the show nearly a month ago. Obviously, with current events, the subjects we may be discussing today may stray a little bit from what we had bargained for back then, but we will stick with both the topic of the book and other questions that you may have, other issues. Harriet Lerner is our guest. She is the author of a series of books dealing with helping women find their voice in relationships, starting with The Dance of Anger back in 1985. Her latest book is entitled The Dance of Connection: How to Talk with Someone When You're Mad, Hurt, Scared, Frustrated, Insulted, Betrayed, or Desperate. However, as we discuss the stress of relationships, perhaps we can't exclude what a tragedy such as last week's terrorist attacks can have on relationships, whether you were directly affected by them or simply one of us millions of people who watched it all from afar on television. And no doubt the stress will continue as we go through the days and weeks ahead and our world changes even more. It will be an interesting world ahead. Harriet Lerner is a psychotherapist and lecturer, and she has been a staff member at the Menninger Clinic in Topeka, Kansas, where she lives and where she joins us this afternoon. Good afternoon, Harriet.
Good afternoon.
Before we start, we certainly welcome and encourage your input as listeners and your questions for Harriet Lerner. Our numbers in Urbana, 333-9455. Those are for local listeners in the Champaign-Urbana area. Outside the area, call us toll-free. The number is 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. And as we get started with the promotional material that came with the book, it listed your tour dates, and it mentioned Monday and Tuesday, September 10th and 11th in New York City. Were you there?
I was there. I was en route from New York to planning to go to Washington, D.C. on September 11th when the unfathomable, painful events occurred. So I just got back to Kansas last night, and I'm glad to be joining you from my home today.
Mm-hmm. It must be good to be back home.
It is good to be back home. It was also good to be in New York.
You are a New Yorker.
I am a New Yorker, and even though, unfortunately, I wasn't able to be helpful when I was there, they rejected both my blood and psychological services because they had so many volunteers, which was wonderful. But it was good to be there to be able to hear people's stories and to make what happened more real for myself.
What did you hear when you were there, and how much, I mean, when did you finally leave New York?
I left last night.
Wow, you've been there a whole week almost.
I actually got from New York to Philadelphia and left from Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And what I heard is the same of what all of our listeners have heard, the enormous grief as well as the wish to be helpful and come together.
How does one assess what happened? I mean, I'm sure that people who never would have thought of discussing issues with a professional are thinking about it now. How do you work with it?
Well, it hasn't happened before.
Mm-hmm.
What has happened before for all of us is, whether it's at a personal level or a political level, and I'm sure there are many listeners who have seen war and devastation, even though they haven't seen this particular circumstance. So what is not new is the complexity of dealing with grief, and grief and loss is the greatest adaptational task that any of us can come to terms with, whether it's the loss of a family member or the loss in massive numbers that happened on the 11th.
And when we say to people, you know, we share your grief, that's not just a saying, not just something that makes people, not just comforts people, but it really must be true that, we are feeling the same kind of grief and loss that other people who are directly affected by this are, in a way. Are we not?
I think that people are showing a tremendous amount of empathy. I think that some of us may respond by being numb and have a sense of disbelief and not being able to make it real, not because such people don't have feelings, but that's one way of dealing with an enormity of feelings. For the people who have actually lost children and spouses, I think there's a recognition that those who haven't lost people care enormously, and yet at some level, one is alone with a profound grief,
right,
which is different than those people who are more peripherally connected.
How does something like this spill over into our relationships with loved ones? I know that, you know, we're talking about two different issues. I mean, people who are suffering that profound grief have just a whole set of things to deal with in another way. But those of us who were just, you know, watching this on television and are moved by it indirectly, how does this, you know, does this change the way we deal with other people too?
I think that everything has changed. There's a great deal of anxiety and fear. It's not a calm emotional climate in our country right now. And when people are very anxious and fearful, whether we're talking about intimate relationships and families or we're talking about larger systems, we're often not at our best. I mean, no one does their best thinking in the midst of a tornado or in the midst of a bombing. So my hope for people, and certainly one challenge for all of us, is to, and a particular challenge for our nation's leaders, is to get enough of a grip on our own intensity and our own anxiety that it doesn't land in relationships and escalate things further. Because it's hard to be a calm and clear thinker in the midst of devastation, whether it's a devastation that's very personal in your family or a national one. So getting a grip on one's own intensity, I think, is the very first challenge.
Taking a step back, I assume. Just
right,
that
taking
kind of thing.
A step back. And, you know, that's easier said than done, because
right,
when people are anxious, we want to rush into action. We're very reactive. I know that relationships are my stock and trade, but when I feel anxious enough or I feel angry enough, I have the brain of a reptile. So this is a time for people to slow down and be more thoughtful.
When do you determine how far back is back when you step back? When do you decide it's okay to step forward and either express my feelings or try to work out a relationship problem after trying to calm down? When do you determine that you're calm?
Well, let me back up a bit, because I don't mean to imply that we have to wait until we're perfectly calm in order to speak. But particularly for parents out there, because as I was in New York, one of the things I was struck by was how concerned parents were about talking with children, that children at this point in time have to handle very, very painful facts. But the more that the parents' anxiety and intensity isn't spilling over, you know, and flooding the family, that would be a challenge to work on. On the other hand, it's ridiculous to say to family members and to all of us to say, well, wait until you're perfectly calm before you say anything, because it's not realistic. We need to speak. And the challenge is, you know, to be able to speak in ways that are productive, rather than ways that our anxiety is just spilling all over the place and the nation becomes one nervous system anxiously twitching together, isn't useful. It's not useful in families. It's not useful on the national scene.
Is there some truth, though, to the phrase, tragedy brings us closer, though?
Yes, tragedy brings people closer, especially when it's an acute tragedy, as this one is. But it's also true, and let me speak as a clinical psychologist now and bring it back to the level of families and intimate relationships, that very often when anxiety remains chronic, and often other people will distance because, you know, they'll want you to be over it, that we don't do our best thinking. So if you look at families that are operating under chronic anxiety, you see the polarities. Either the lines of communication shut down and people can't talk together about things that matter, or you see the opposite. The parent's anxiety is just spilling over and children aren't protected enough from adult anxieties. Or, for example, if you look at a very anxious family system, the leadership will be rigid and authoritarian. On the one hand, or you'll see the opposite. The family may be operating like a blob of protoplasm with no clear leadership or rules or consequences or boundaries. So the challenge at the level of families, and I think it's the same in larger systems, is to move away from the extremes and the polarities and to aim for a more balanced, objective view. By the way, easier said than done, of course.
And you do talk about that in the first chapters of the book, about how differing families, you know, the way we've built up our communication patterns over time as families, how they differ so widely and how we address differences in relationships differently.
Right.
It's a challenge that you have to fine-tune to your own family upbringing and the way you all handle things.
Of course. And there are many, many ways to handle an anxious situation. Some people will handle it by being more private, and other people handle anxious situations by wanting to talk about it or over-talk about it, which would be my own style. And I think that at a time like this, actually all the time, to be able to respect the different ways that people manage their own intensity is very important. The Dance of Connection, which is the book that I was on tour with when I thought I was heading from New York to Washington, is about dealing with the most difficult people in the most difficult circumstances. And I think that a lot of the, I don't know whether to call it rules of communication, but a lot of the ways that we understand families, I believe, are relevant for understanding larger systems as well.
Mm-hmm. Our numbers, if you want to talk with Harriet Lerner this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, are 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. Outside the area, 1-800-222-9455. We have a caller on line one. Good afternoon.
Yes, hello. I'm literally en route back from the East Coast and have driven through Delaware and Baltimore and Maryland and Western Maryland and Pennsylvania, and one of the things I am overcome by is the fact that at every overpass there are flowers and sheets, you know, with signs, God bless, and noting, I don't know, there's sort of this upwelling of the American psyche that's, I think, really bringing us together, and it was quite overcoming, and I just wondered if you could comment on how this kind of tragedy tends to make us seek each other out as a country and unify in some ways. I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Sure.
It's very inspiring, and I had the same reaction of being amazed at the courage of people and the love of people and the coming together of people in the face of tragedy. I think the larger challenge is extending that kind of compassion and connection to the entire human family. Because, of course, in our anxiety and our coming together, very often people come together at the expense of other people, or we come together at the expense of another group or nation. And we're in a very complicated political situation. So my hope is that the love and compassion and coming together and doing our best thinking will extend to the entire human family because we are all in this boat together.
Does something like this make it easier or tougher for relationships that may have been damaged or broken off in the past to be repaired? Is it something that, do you put off things like that? You mentioned waiting a minute until you're calm, but does this have play a role in long term, you know, helping ease over differences among family members or close friends?
I think it does both. I think that when we're dealing with a situation like this, that it can bring families and relationships closer together by helping people to put things in perspective, because we hang on to so much petty anger and bitterness and righteousness and get into so much corrosive fighting and blaming in marriage when the mature thing would be to let, you know, 96% of it go and address what's important. So I think that one thing that happens in the face of a tragedy like this is it can put things in perspective and people can come together in a more loving way. It also does the opposite. When people get very anxious, they cut off, they get catapulted into affairs, they fall in love with someone they would never be, you know, interested in, that's sitting next to them in a bus or at work. So I think that it can work both to the anxiety in the emotional field, can work both to bring people together in some cases and to evoke some people to fly apart. Mm-hmm. So the challenge would be to not fly apart and to aim for more connection and compassion.
There's an email that we had gotten last week, and we thought it might be a decent question to ask, though not necessarily in the topic of family relationships. But somebody wrote last week asking how people can deal with the anxiety of just waiting for the next event. You know, what there's that anxiety that something else may happen, or there's the anxiety about what the nation does in response. How do you deal with that?
First of all, to realize that you're not alone, that this is an anxious time, and although it's not the American way to surrender to grief or anxiety or painful feelings, we're supposed to fix things and pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and get over it, that the reality is that it is an anxious time. And it's also the reality that some of the media is certainly escalating the anxiety way beyond what is useful or helpful to people. And the best thing to do is to stay as connected as possible to other people and to do the things that you know from experience help you to be a little calmer. You know, I don't care whether it's exercising or gardening or
getting
calling
away from
your
the television
best friend
somehow,
or turning off your television or getting a distracting video. And I don't mean to say these things to put a false patina of brightness on what's happening, but I think that we each know from our experience better than any expert or psychologist what has helped us to be calmer in the past and that we can do those things. And I also think that the more we behave honorably and lovingly at this time toward people in our own family and our own community, the calmer we'll feel and ultimately be on more sturdy ground than if we react with bitterness and hate and vengeance.
Interesting that you do say that you're talking about surrendering not being the American way. But you deal, I guess, indirectly with something like that in the book about the ability to let go of a grudge or an argument, just to stop the argument for the sake of stopping the argument. It's difficult for people to do that, difficult for people to surrender their side in a dispute or a difference of opinion with a friend or relative.
Right, and surrender has very negative connotations. And, you know, we do like to think that we're in charge and that we run the show. And I don't mean surrendering in terms of passivity. We all want to be good problem solvers. We all want to be clear enough to roll up our sleeves and get through the day in a fairly competent way, but there can be a great strength in having the maturity to recognize that we don't run the show. And there's a great strength in being able to use our voice to share pain and vulnerability. Because when we think about having a voice and having a strong voice and being strong, we tend to think about things like that we can voice our anger and we can say what we think and we can take an I position. And another aspect of strength is to be able to share our problems and our vulnerabilities and our fears and to be able to call someone up and say, can you come over? I need you. I need help. I'm not doing well. This is especially hard for eldest daughters to do. I say as a psychotherapist that, for example, eldest daughters, particularly if you were raised in a family where one or both parents were not very attuned to your needs, you may possess a towering competence to help other people and fix things. But you may not be very good at putting forth your own needs and limits and vulnerability in a way that allows other people to really hear you and give you some help. So a challenge that's there in intimate relationships and also there at every level of systems is sharing a balance of competence and vulnerability.
And that balance is often not easy to strike.
No, it's not.
Between letting your feelings out and then keeping them contained.
And also some of us, you know, are real fix-it, do-it-yourselfers, and we're going to be out there being terribly competent. And others of us in anxious situations tend to under-function and have trouble using our competence, and we have vulnerability spilling over all, you know, all over the place. And it is a challenge, whether the relationship is with your mother or your partner or on the national scene, there is a great strength in learning to share both your competence as well as your vulnerability and problems. We all have both, and that's something we can practice.
You mentioned early on in the book that you draw a lot of these ideas and concepts from your family. Explain a little about what you saw in your own family.
The dance of connection was inspired by my father. It was after his death in 1998, shortly before his 89th birthday, that I began to think about the ways that my dad inspired not just the new book, The Dance of Connection, but way back to my first book, The Dance of Anger. And my father inspired my work not only by being a very witty, articulate, and engaging storyteller. He also inspired it because in my family growing up, he had no voice at all. He would not or could not speak out about anything that mattered. And that, I think, has a lot to do with my passion for helping people to be able to talk about emotionally difficult issues.
Mm-hmm. And it materialized and went from there.
Right. It went from there to The Dance of Connection, which is the first book I've written that has quite a bit about men. Because when it comes to the issue of having a voice and being heard and being able to share both competence and vulnerability and knowing what to do in very painful, difficult circumstances, like that someone cuts off from you and won't show up for the conversation, these are not only women's issues.
Right.
The issue of having a voice is an equal opportunity employer.
But
and I certainly learned that from my dad.
You mentioned that your books have been written for women in the past, the other parts of the Dance trilogy. What kind of a departure was it to write for a more general audience now? And you do mention though that this book is still has things that women can certainly relate to.
Absolutely, and I do. I actually, what I don't do is I don't do men do it this way and women do it that way.
Right.
I think that at this point in history, we really tend to polarize the sexes. We even talk about the opposite sex, not the neighboring sex, mind you, but the
opposite. Men are from Mars, right. Women from Venus concept.
Right, exactly. And it's difficult to talk about gender because on the one hand, humans are more alike than different, and certainly the current tragedy and watching men and women and their responses, you certainly observe how as humans we're much more alike than different. And it's also true that gender, whether you're raised male or female, is a very important filter through which we see the world. So it's hard to talk about gender and to talk about men and women without either exaggerating the differences, which isn't useful, or acting as if they don't exist, when indeed, especially in marriage, there are striking differences often between the problems men and women have being heard and speaking out.
Was it a challenge at all honing the writing to a different, a more general kind of audience?
No. I still write, when you read it, I still write to women in the sense when I say we, blah, 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 and I say, and men, because I feel as a woman I speak to women in a different way. But it wasn't a challenge to be more inclusive of men. Men have been reading my books for a long time. I know because they write to me and tell me, and they usually say, you know, my therapist made me read The Dance of Anger, or my therapist made me read, you know, whatever.
Is that usually in trying to explore a relationship with
Right,
with a partner?
Because, yes, because as I said, and I really do believe this, that as humans, we are certainly more alike than different. And I think that this business of exaggerating the differences. Now, I should add that there are many people who consider marriage to be a cross-cultural experience, if not an interspecies exercise. And a friend of mine, Jennifer Berman, has a wonderful cartoon that shows a dog and a cat in bed together. And the dog is looking morose and reading a book called Dogs Who Love Too Much. And the cat is saying, I'm not distancing. I'm a cat, damn it. And it's a wonderful cartoon because it helps us to lighten up about some of the differences between men and women. Mm-hmm. But sometimes in lightening up, there's a problem because women learn to not expect enough from men. Like if, for example, you know, if I expected my cat to fetch a stick or to protect me if someone entered the house, I'd be in trouble because it's not in his cat nature. Mm-hmm. So too often we conclude, well, it's not in the male nature or it's not in a woman's nature to do whatever, be president of the United States, when it's not useful to exaggerate the differences in this way. So,
there's,
you know,
a lot more shared
than complicated
right,
to talk about gender.
Right. But one other difference that you bring up in the first chapters of the book, I mean, not only a difference in gender, but a difference in how different families are raised in, you know, different traditions, different cultures, different nationalities, even our ancestry. Some believe that, you know, those differences confine communications in some way. Don't we fall sometimes into a trap of rationalizing communication problems with, well, it was my upbringing, or, you know, I happen to be of X, you know, a type of what
yes.
Civilization that I grew up in or ancestry I grew up in, so you can expect that from me, that sort of thing?
Yes, Tom, in fact, you're saying that reminds me of a cartoon that I mentioned in The Dance of Connection that many of our listeners may have seen in the New Yorker magazine. And it shows a woman in the witness box in a courtroom, and she's saying, well, he may have cheated on me because of his childhood abuse, but I shot him because of mine. And I think very often we can use the past to not be accountable for our actions. And we have to be accountable for our actions. At the same time, to understand how our own history, our color, class, racism, sexism, homophobia, to understand how these things affect us, allow for a more compassionate, objective view. So we need to look at our families and the broader context to be more compassionate to ourselves and to others, but we need also to be accountable for our behavior and to hold others accountable for their behavior.
Harriet Lerner is our guest on the Afternoon Magazine. Our numbers, once again, you are certainly welcome to call, offer your questions for Harriet Lerner in regards to relationships, in regards to what we think in the wake of what's happened in the last week. Any subject I would suppose is welcome. The number is 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, outside the area, 1-800-222-9455. One part of the book that you advise people to remember is that you need to listen when we're talking about handling disputes and relationships. You ask people not to expect to give advice, for example, when somebody confronts you with a problem or offers feelings, that you should just listen. But that's got to be an awful tough urge to fight, the urge
right.
to give advice.
And it's fine to give advice if it's welcome. I give advice myself. I'm paid to give advice. Sometimes I can't help myself from giving advice. Listening is really the ultimate spiritual exercise and the most precious gift that we can often give another person if we really listen to understand. And it's easy to listen to understand if you're nodding vigorously in agreement with what the other person is saying. If the other person, say a partner or a child, is attacking you or criticizing you, we tend to listen defensively, meaning we tend to listen for the exaggerations and distortions and inaccuracies that are inevitably there. The challenge is to listen differently, to really shift into another frame of mind and listen for, even if it's 2%, for that piece that you can agree with and apologize first. And it's quite a remarkable shift in a relationship when someone can stop listening defensively and really open their heart to listen only to understand, not to prepare their case, not to argue back, not to make their point, but just to understand.
And not to expect that other person who is starting the conversation is expecting an answer in return.
Right. And, you know, to give an example, a personal example on a very sort of teensy subject, my husband and I have a verbal agreement that when he gets downstairs into the kitchen, because he gets downstairs first in the morning, that he will open up the blinds. And he was forgetting, quote, forgetting to open up the blinds. So we had this enormous fight where I made this great big deal of it and said all the wrong things. I mean, really, if I were practicing what I preach, I would have simply said, you know, you said you would open the blinds, and this is the third time in a row that you haven't opened the blinds. But instead I said, you know, you don't follow through, and, you know, how can I count on anything?
That's your
you
problem.
Say? And, you know, sort of globalizing it to his entire character. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it elicited a fight, and he said, my God, you know, you're making such a big deal out of it. Look at what I do for the family. I do A, B, C, and D, and here you are talking about the blinds. And in the middle of this fight, and I don't know what led him to shift, he suddenly made a shift where he totally stopped arguing and became interested and wanting to listen to understand why, when someone makes a verbal contract with me, like he says, I will open the blinds, to understand why it is so important to me that he follows through. And he just sat there and listened and asked me questions about the pieces that he didn't understand. And that kind of transition, which meant a great deal to me, is a great gift to be able to give somebody.
And so much depends on how that other person responds, doesn't it?
Well,
or does it?
Yes, of course we all, you know, we read these books because secretly, of course, we hope that if we communicate better or do better ourselves, the other person will get it or shape up or come back and apologize. In reality, speaking of things we can't control, we can never control the outcome of a relationship. But to calm down, to listen well, to speak with dignity and honor and compassion is such a good thing to do, even if we don't get the response we want. So as a therapist, I put a lot of energy into helping people, and in my work as an author, to help people get very self-focused, which is not self-blaming, but to really pay a lot of attention to how we are navigating relationships.
We have a call on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You talked earlier about the eldest female
right.
in the family. And I would like to know what methods or what kind of suggestions there are or how to learn to be more vulnerable and not go around helping everybody else.
It's very, very difficult. So the first thing is to understand how difficult it is, because if you're a firstborn daughter and you've swept your own needs under the rug for at least a lifetime, it's going to be very hard to give voice to your vulnerability or to be able to say, perhaps you're caring for an aging parent or someone who needs your help, to be able to say, I can't do this. I'm feeling so tired and depleted that we need to call in the troops. There's a limit to what I can do. And what the place to start is just getting your toes wet in the water and starting to practice anywhere you can. I mean, it may be calling up a sister or a friend and saying something like, I'm so upset and I'm so anxious and I just need you to listen, or I just want you to cook me dinner tonight. I'm a little bit of a basket case tonight. However you can practice, or being able to say, you know, I can't do it. I am so tired and so exhausted and so upset about what's happening in work or in the world that I can't be of help tonight. I can't even talk on the phone tonight. So wherever you can practice putting forth limits or your own needs or vulnerability, not because you're going to get a certain response, but because you'll be on firmer ground if you can get a little bit of practice. So think of where you could start, because you would be the best expert in knowing that. It's a very, very good question, and I talk about it at length in The Dance of Connection, because, you know, we think about having a voice, we think about, you know, being tough and strong, and it takes so much courage to put forth the softer, more vulnerable aspects of yourself, again, especially if you're a firstborn eldest.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for your call. What about situations where you're trying to connect with somebody who just does not respond at all? It's to the point where they don't talk to you. Where do you start in a situation like that?
It's a very painful situation. I mean, one of the very painful places in relationships is when somebody not only cuts off from you, but they cut off and they won't show up for the conversation. And it really depends on what the relationship is. Sometimes, for example, if you're in a love relationship and someone cuts off, that what you need to do is to get a grip on your wish to desperately pursue them, and to really take care of yourself and give that person space. You can have an allergy model in your mind, because if the data is when you move toward that person, they distance even more, then it's important to be able to move toward other people for help and support. And sometimes people that we love and care about move on and leave us, and ultimately we have to learn to leave the table when love's no longer being served. That was a sign when I went to school in Madison, Wisconsin, as an undergraduate. A dear friend of mine had this poster up in his kitchen, and it said, you You've got to learn to leave the table when love's no longer being served. So you hang in and you try to process it in a calm way, and you don't pursue. But my advice is very different if it's a family member, because if your mother has cut you off or your child has cut you off, my advice is to never leave the table. And there's a very fine line to be walked, because if your kid or your parent says, "You are no longer my mother, you're no longer my son, I want nothing to do with you," the fine line is we both need to respect the wish for no contact, and yet we need to keep our hearts open for the possibility of connection and to make decisions about how to stay connected. So, for example, in the book I talk about a mother who was cut off by her adult son after she divorced the father. The son was firmly, firmly entrenched in his dad's camp, and he said to his mother, "You're not my mother, I'll never see you." She both needed to not pursue him, to respect the fact that he couldn't tolerate contact. But at the same time, she could stand for connection. His position was, "I don't have a mother." Her position was, "It's too painful for me to pretend I don't have a son." Mm-hmm. So she would occasionally, with my coaching, send him cards every few weeks. Or if something important happened in the family, she would send him a note saying, "Uncle Cy is having surgery next Wednesday. I thought you'd want to know." And she would let him know without pursuing him, without trying to convince him, without pushing for contact. She would let him know that she loved him, and if he was ever ready to talk, that she was there. So she was able, in a very low-key way, to stand for some connection, to take the position, "I cannot pretend that I don't have a son," and yet also to respect that contact was not possible for him at that time. And that's a very fine, difficult line for us to walk.
We have time for one call. Hopefully we'll be able to handle this call. It's in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi. And I don't mean to derail the conversation, but since next month is Domestic Violence Month, and I perceive that as being an issue that cuts across gender, and so I'm very glad you talked about gender issues. What I find challenging sometimes working with individuals who are in a situation like that, and I'm just interested in your perceptions, is that, and I don't know if it's we as Americans or just acculturated people, you know, men and women tend to tolerate different levels of aggression and violence. And I'm just curious if you've had to train both men and women in recognizing, you know, hard stares and grunting as at times violence, and if you've noticed that maybe women tend to address their own behavior as being very violent when it's, you know, not really that aggressive, and diminish perhaps the aggression of men just because of our societal role. So whatever you have to say, I'd be interested to listen to. Thank you.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you for bringing up the subject of violence at the level of what happens in people's homes and relationships, because it's at every level of our society. You know, it's at the broader national level we're thinking about, and it's at the most intimate level. And, you know, all I can say is that it's a very difficult challenge when things escalate out of control. It's a difficult challenge when you're working with a perpetrator of violence to be able to both hold that person accountable and yet to understand that every human is so much better and more complex than the worst things they ever do. Because men and women, but we're talking more about men, won't feel accountable and responsible for their own violence if it kicks them into an identity of worthlessness when all of us are so complex. And for the victims of violence who aren't able to leave or don't leave, the last thing that the victims need is to be further shamed or blamed for either loving someone who's violent or the situations they're in. But as we give people a more complex sense of self-worth, this is both for both men and women, and help people to really clarify their core values and who are the people that they want to become over the next 5 or 10 years. What is their picture for themselves and their relationships? There are few people who either wish to be violent or wish to be the objects of violence. And again, this is something we're all in together. The challenge that's so alive for us today of how to be a more loving and compassionate society in both intimate relationships mm-hmm. and in broader systems.
And with that, we have to close. We're out of time for this afternoon. Harriet Lehner, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The book is called The Dance of Connection. Harriet Lehner has been our guest this afternoon. The book is from HarperCollins.